Now let us open our Bibles together to the Epistle of Paul to the Church of Ephesus, chapter 6. Ephesians, chapter 6. And I begin reading at verse 10, which is Paul's exhortation to us as we complete another year, 1993. Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of His might. Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. Wherefore take unto you the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. Stand therefore, having your loins girt about with truth, and having on the breastplate of righteousness, and your feet shod with the preparation of the gospel of peace. Above all, taking the shield of faith, wherewith ye shall be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked. And take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God. I have concluded the reading with the 17th verse of the 6th chapter of Ephesians. How the time passes. How often do I hear that expression at the end of each year? At home I have a big clock on the face of which are the Latin words tempus fugit, which simply means time passes. Indeed, it does. We have come to the end of 1993, and it does not seem possible that we are already here. Likewise, it doesn't seem possible that we are quickly approaching the end of a whole century of time. And frankly, we are just as near to the end of a whole millennium. You would think that with all of this time for experience, that we would have learned how to live. But the tragedy is, the world seems to know no more today about how to live successfully with each other than we did at the beginning. About 200 years ago, William Wordsworth wrote these words: "The world is too much with us. Late and soon, getting and spending, we lay waste our powers. Little we see in nature that is ours. We have given our hearts away, a sordid boon. This sea that bears her bosom to the moon, the winds that will be howling at all hours, and are upgathered now like sleeping flowers. For this, for everything, we are out of tune. It moves us not. Great God! I'd rather be a pagan suckled in a creed outworn. So might I, standing on this pleasant lea, have glimpses that would make me less forlorn, have sight of Proteus rising from the sea, or hear old Triton blow his wreathed horn." Now, in all of that, William Wordsworth is simply saying 200 years ago, for all of our advances in every area of life, we are still a pagan people. And I'd just as soon be a pagan worshiping old Proteus of the sea or Triton with his wreathed horn as to live in a world like this. Now, 200 years have passed and nothing much has changed. Our technology has been much improved and we are able to do a lot of things today which seem to be almost miraculous even to us. And yet, in spite of that, we still abort our babies, we shoot our neighbors, we curse our teachers and destroy our homes, we vote for crooks, we glorify perversion, we protect criminals, we despise religion, and we exploit just about everyone and everything for our own personal ends. And so we have more crime now than we've ever had before, and we have more broken homes than we've ever had before, and we have more unwanted children than we've ever had before. And we have more depression than we've ever had before. And we need more psychiatrists than we ever needed before. And all of this precisely because we haven't learned from our experiences how we ought to live. Now this morning we are saying goodbye to 1993. And we are greeting with a warm hello 1994. And we are thinking of 1994 as a new and better day. In fact, we're almost glad to see 1993 go, because somehow it seems like 1993 has been like a disease which we hope has run its course and will literally die and give us a chance for some new rebirth. This, you see, really is not the end of anything much. It is hopefully the beginning of something very wonderful. This 1994. We are closing out one year and we are commencing another year. And when we look at 1994, the first thing we think about is what a great opportunity, but we must also remember that with the opportunity comes a tremendous responsibility. As I look at 1994 and look back on 1993, I think of a boy or a girl who has been given a new car by dad and who carelessly wrecks the car, and then dad gives them another brand new car and they say, "Oh, what a wonderful opportunity." But dad says it's a responsibility. You better not wreck this one. Life is before us in 1994. It spreads itself like a green bay tree and it offers to share its joys as well as its sorrows with us. For literally the world is waiting for us as the first day of January approaches. And I look out there upon 1994 and I'm aware that there are many wrongs which need to be righted. There's war which it seems will never go away. And if I am to take Jesus at face value, and who would dare say that I am not to do that? Jesus warned us that there would be wars and rumors of wars until the very end of time. And if I had some powers of prognostication, I would predict this morning that we will see more wars and more conflicts in 1994 than we did in 1993. And indeed, there was conflict and hostility and war everywhere all over the world this year. And there is poverty. Oh, there is so much poverty, and there's so much disease which cuts man down. And there's so much racial discrimination and lack of brotherhood between blacks and whites, and so much religious war. Did you know that most wars, ultimately, if you trace them back to their origin, most wars are fought because of some kind of deep-seated religious belief? And we are fighting all over the world today because of religion. Our fathers in 1993 have left us a great deal to do on the workbench of the world. It's putty in our hands, it's pliable, and 1994 is going to give itself to us, and we can do with it exactly what we want, but what we do, we will bequeath to our children. And so it is a very serious responsibility which we approach. You can make life exactly what you want it to be. If you want 1994 to be a lifetime of strength and wholesomeness, then it will be that. If you apply yourself, if you're willing for it to be weak and anemic, then that's all it's going to be. Somewhere I saw an old German recipe, Tim, for making coffee. The best recipe for making coffee I have ever seen. It says, put some in. I think the trouble with most coffee is we don't put enough in. And if you don't put much into your life, you're not going to get much out of it. If you make a stingy investment, you're going to get a very weak return. And your life can be about as weak and as thin as some coffee which we try to drink. John Hughes once wrote, "To live long is almost everyone's wish, but to live well is the ambition of a few." Well, we knew that before he said it, didn't we? We all want the rewards, but we don't want the responsibility. And yet life is not going to give up its secrets to us if we're indolent. The world needs strong hands. It needs strong minds and strong hearts. President Garfield was asked when he was a little boy what he was going to be when he became a man. He said, "I think I'll make myself a man first, because if I don't succeed in that, I won't succeed in anything else." What kind of a man or woman do you want to be in 1994? Honest, dependable, trustworthy, helpful? Do you want to be a part of the solution of the problems of the world, or do you want to be a part of the problem which just keeps hanging around? The old Greek Diogenes used to go through the streets of Athens with his lamp, looking for something, and the people would always ask him what he was looking for, and he would say, "I'm looking for an honest man." Well, the world is still looking for honest men and women. And believe me, there will be times when you and I will stand alone if we are honest and dependable and trustworthy. Times when the world will laugh at us because of the positions we take, the things we believe, the things we try to do. Galileo was only 18 years old when he began experimenting with swinging balls. And everybody laughed at Galileo. And yet, eventually, it was his experimentation with those swinging balls that taught us how to make a pendulum clock. And Galileo used to get up on the top of the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and he would drop balls off to the ground, big ones and small ones, and heavy ones and light ones, and they would all hit the ground at the same time. And he was trying to prove something about gravity, and the people just laughed at him as if he were insane. And he took his old crude telescope, and he sought to prove to the world that Copernicus before him was right, who said that the earth moves around the sun, and people just continued to laugh at him. But he took his stand. And we are the richer today, because here was a man who was willing to be laughed at, to take his stand, to be honest and dependable and trustworthy, and to do what he knew he had to do, no matter what other people thought. And over in France in the 16th century, there was a gentleman named Palissy who kept saying to the people, in this business of making ceramics, and that was his business, he said, "I know that if I can just get the fire hot enough, I will make the colors a part of the ceramic." And they laughed at him. And while they laughed, he kept saying, "More fire, more fire, more fire." And he was right, and everybody else was wrong. And one day Jesus Christ walked the earth, and he said, "You people are all wrong in your philosophy, the way you live. It's wrong. You don't beat each other over the head to get what you want. You don't force people to do what you want them to do. You don't treat people like enemies. You treat people like friends. You love each other. You help each other. You share with each other." And they laughed at him, and they scorned him, and eventually they nailed him on a cross. And if you take your stand as an honest and dependable and trustworthy person who believes in something and who does something, obviously the world may crucify you, but the world will not forget you. And so we need to pursue our dreams, and we need to defend our ideals if we're going to discover any kind of an effective life. There is a recipe for living, and I want to share that with you in just a few minutes here this morning. It's a very simple kind of a recipe. My wife is one of the best cooks in the world, and yet even my wife can ruin a good recipe by adding too many unnecessary things. You have to keep recipes usually pretty simple. Christmas Day, my wife made a hash brown casserole. That was good. But as we ate this hash brown casserole, one of our twin sons said to his mother, "Mother, wouldn't this have just been a lot better if you just used potatoes and nothing else?" Well, I had to agree with him. Just plain hash brown potatoes would have been a lot better than that fancy casserole. Let me read you a recipe that you won't believe. This recipe comes from the 18th century, and it's out of a recipe book for making salads. And this is what it says. It says, "Put in a multitude of ingredients. Add a little of this and a touch of that, a flavor of something else, and then everything imaginable that you can think of. And then open the window and throw out the whole mess." That's what we do with our lives. That's the trouble with our lives. We keep adding so much that's unnecessary to the simplicity of living. And we keep introducing all kinds of worldly flavors to try to spice it up and stiff it up a bit. And the result is we make a mess of our lives. We major in minors, and we have so many things going that we have no time for the one or two things we really ought to be doing. There was a silly little old song that used to be popular when I was younger, and the refrain of it went, accentuate the positive, latch on to the affirmative, and don't mess with Mr. In-Between. Good advice for making a life. Frankly, there are only two basic ingredients in this recipe for living. You have to begin with an abundance of faith. Faith, that's the stuff at the rock bottom of the recipe of life. Faith. The biggest obstacle which the Israelites faced as they tried to get into the promised land was the Red Sea. And the book of Hebrews in chapter 11, verse 29 says, it was by faith that they passed through the Red Sea as by dry land, which the Egyptians, essaying to do, were drowned. It was faith that got them across the sea. It was faith that got them into the land of promise. And when the Egyptians tried to pass through on the dry ground of the Red Sea, where the waters had been congealed on either side, it was a terminus. It was a disaster for them because the churning, whirling waters forced themselves down upon them and spit their bodies out like pebbles on the beach. But for the Israelites, it was a victory. It was a thoroughfare. And what was the difference? Why was it a disaster for the Egyptians, and why was it a thoroughfare of victory for the Israelites? It was not because the Israelites were more cultured than the Egyptians, because they weren't. The Egyptians were the most cultured people of the world of that time. It wasn't because the Israelites were more powerful than the Egyptians. The Egyptians had all the power and all the machinery and all the artillery and all the military, and the Israelites, well, they were just really a bunch of slaves, and they had no equipment. It certainly wasn't because God loved the Israelites more than he loved the Egyptians, because there are no heaven's favorites. God is no respecter of people. It was faith that made the difference. The Israelites heard their God say to them, this is a new beginning for you, it's a new year, it's a new life, now get on with it, and they believed that he would divide those waters like he promised, and they walked right through. And the Egyptians had no confidence in that kind of a God. They thought it was some sort of magic, and so they just took it for granted, and they were all drowned in the Red Sea. Now, you can't get very far in life without faith, friends. I hear some people arguing all the time that we Christians are silly to try to live by faith, because you live by what you see and touch and feel and sense. You don't live by faith. Nobody can live by faith. And some of them argue that they cannot even believe that God created the heavens and the earth, because that takes too much faith. So what do? They believe it was just an accident. Now I ask you, what takes more faith? To believe that the heavens and the earth happened by accident? Or to believe that there is a divine mind somewhere who brought all this together and made this? When I got into a car, in fact, when I got into my car this morning and came over here to church, I would have never gotten here if I hadn't believed that my car was dependable enough to get me to my destination. That doesn't mean anything except that if I hadn't believed the car would get me here, I wouldn't have gotten in it to begin with. A number of years ago, I was flying back from England, and I was on a plane which we discovered was crippled. And the plane landed at Shannon, Ireland for some maintenance and some repairs. And we sat in the middle of the night in the terminal waiting for them to repair the plane for about 4 hours. And when we finally boarded the plane again and they taxied down the runway, they discovered that it still wouldn't go. And so we had to get off and wait a while longer. And there we were in Shannon, Ireland, waiting to hop across the Atlantic. And I was scared to death. And the plane I was going to get on had been landed because it wouldn't fly, and now we'd tried to get it off the ground, it wouldn't go again. And here we were going to get on that thing and go across the Atlantic. Can you imagine how much faith it took for me to get on that plane? It took a tremendous amount of faith, or I would have never gotten on the plane at all. My wife loves flowers, and she plants gardens every spring because she has faith. She just believes they're going to grow. If she didn't believe that, she wouldn't plant them. My dear mother, a number of years ago, stopped using the United States mail service. She'd lost 2 or 3 letters in the mail. And when a grandchild had a birthday, she would hand me a birthday card, usually with a little bit of money in it, and she'd say, "Will you take this and give it to the grandchild?" And I would say, "Mother, why don't you mail it? It means so much more." No, I don't think it'll get there in the mail." And so she didn't use the mail anymore because she lost confidence in it. If you didn't have faith, you wouldn't get out of bed in the morning. You have to have faith in yourself. You have to have faith in others and faith in life, because you're going to have an extremely difficult time trying to get through 1994 if you don't believe in anyone or anything. I suggest that what we need to do this morning is to begin right now massaging our faith and developing the muscles of our faith, because that's the basic ingredient in the recipe for living. And coupled with that other faith that I've been talking about, there is, of course, that specific faith in God, which is not a luxury indeed. There's nothing worthwhile in this world without faith in God. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity without faith in God. It's an essential to good living. And all of us are moving not just into 1994, where we need faith in God, but we are moving step by step, year by year, moment by moment, to the grand terminus of earthly existence, when we're going to have to take the wings of that butterfly. And if you don't have faith, there won't be any wings. The other ingredient in the recipe for living, and there are only 2 in this simple recipe, not a lot of stuff, just 2. The other recipe is you have to add to faith, which is the basic ingredient, a whole lot of courage. Paul used to talk about faith. Paul said faith is absolutely everything. There isn't anything else. Believe, and everything's possible. He's exactly right. James, his friend, used to say, "Paul, now wait a minute, there is another side of that story. Because show me a man who has faith and doesn't do anything, and I'll show you a man who does something, and let's see who has the best faith." James said, faith isn't any good by itself. You've got to have courage enough to put your faith to work. And so James was talking about practicing what Paul was preaching. You believe in God. You believe in life. You have faith. Now have the courage to do something with it. Put a handle on it and get on with the business of living. I doubt that there's anybody in this congregation this morning who would dispute the fact that we have made a mess of 1993. The whole world has made a mess of 1993. And I think America has made the biggest mess in the whole world. Nothing we've done has turned out right in 1993. And I'm not being a pessimist at that point, because I believe we can change things. I'm being a realist at that point. I am told that the giant tortoise lives longer than any other creature. They tell me that a 600-pound tortoise is probably as much as 300 years old. He's been around here a long, long time, and yet what does he do? He does nothing but mope and hide under his shell. He pulls his head in, he pulls his feet in, and hides every time there's any problem under his shell. Now, who wants to live like that? And yet there's a sense in which that's the way we've been living. We're not willing to take the risks which are necessary to create the new kind of world which we need. And you've got to take risks. You've got to stick your neck out. The turtle needs to stick his neck out. You're going to get nicked in the neck if you do, but still, that's a part of living, isn't it? I used to hear Bishop Watkins. He's been dead now a long time. His mother's probably already met him this morning. Bishop Watkins was the bishop when I came into the Methodist Church. He ordained me in the ministry. He was an old man at that time. I used to hear him say, I've never forgotten, just keep thinking about it a lot. I used to hear him say, the difference between a young man and an old man can be seen in the way they approach a traffic light. He said, when a young man approaches a red light, he steps on the gas because he's afraid that it will turn green before. When he approaches a green light, he steps on the gas because he's afraid it'll turn red before he gets there. And when the old man approaches a green light, he steps on the brake because he's afraid it'll turn red before he gets there. That's the way we live, isn't it? And friends, you can't go through life with your foot on the brake. Now, nobody wants to be careless and run red lights, but you can't go through life with your foot on the brake. I read somewhere about a woman who always drove with her emergency brake on because she said, I'm afraid there's going to be an emergency and I want to be prepared. You can't live like that. David was an example of a courageous youth. His brother said to him, who do you think you are? You're just a young upstart. And we are the military men, and yet you want to go out there and face Goliath, this 10-foot-tall giant of the Philistines? And you remember the story. You remember what happened. How David was able, with his little slingshot and his pebbles, to bring victory to the Israelites, because he was a man who had faith in God and a man who had courage to put his faith into practice. Well, you've got a chance this year. All of you have got a chance to do something. You've got a chance to sell your soul like Mephistopheles, who sold his soul to the devil, if that's what you want to do. God's not going to stand in your way if that's what you want to do. Or you've got a chance to meet your Red Sea like Hamlet, who put an end to his life because the young prince of Denmark couldn't handle it. If that's what you want to do, you can just end it. You can just cut it off and be done with it. Or you can meet your life like Goliath, like David, who fought Goliath with faith and courage. My recipe, in conclusion, is this. I wrote this out, so I'm going to read it to you. It sounds like it's got a lot of ingredients in it, which I've been saying you shouldn't do, but it hasn't. It's just got a couple. My recipe is, pour into the crucible of life a large measure of faith. Add a generous portion of courage. Mix well with a sufficient amount of the milk of human kindness to produce a smooth batter of life. When thoroughly blended, add a measure of dedication, 2 measures of perseverance, a measure of integrity, and a pinch of patience, and cook in a preheated oven of opposition until done. It'll serve you as long as you live. That's a pretty good recipe, I think, even if I did write it. Faith, that's the way you begin. Courage, that's the way you continue. Mix those things together. Norman Vincent Peale died Christmas Eve too. You heard about that, didn't you? He was 95 years old. What a great man he was. What great books he wrote. He was always talking about the power of positive thinking. But if you'd talked to Norman Vincent Peale, you would have known that he was talking about more than just thinking positively. He was talking about putting your positive thoughts into action, being courageous enough to positively face life. And he helped masses of people with his philosophy. When Moses met the Red Sea, he had faith and he had courage enough to walk right in. And when Joshua confronted the walls of Jericho, he had faith to believe that they'd fall, but he didn't just have faith. He blew the trumpet because he knew it would happen. And when Samson came out blinded by the Philistines and put his hands on the pillars of that temple, he had faith to believe that the temple would come down, and so he pushed on the pillars. He had courage to put his faith into practice. And when Jesus went to the cross, he had faith to believe that the tomb would open and he would come out again. And when they rolled away the stone from the tomb, he had already come out. Friends, you can do with 1994 what you want to. It's in your hands. But the recipe for living is to have faith and great courage and to get on with the business of living and see if we can't do a better job with 1994 than we did with 1993. Let us pray. Father in heaven, we thank you this morning for this new opportunity that is ours as we face this new year. We thank you that there is a responsibility, a massive responsibility. We pray that we'll be up to it, that we'll accept it, and we'll do it to the best of our ability. And help us to remember that as long as we have God with us, and as long as we are on God's side, that the victory is not only possible, but it's a certainty. In the name of Christ, amen.